Yeah, well, I think the time is just something to watch along. I think it's time we got some other voices in this, and I've really enjoyed this. this gentleman here.
I must say, I love the talk. It's fantastic.
Mark Mazin for UCL. I have to say, I love your talk because I think that David Cameron and the Greeks should actually employ you, because I think using your selective use of data, there would be no world recession and Greeks would not be in debt. But I'm not going to pick apart any of your talk. What I really want to get to is why are Kevin, myself, and all the other climate scientists that we meet so naive, so stupid, and have been completely wrong about this, and you're right?
I've no idea. That's the question. If you think that's what you're being, then you're giving me an answer. But I can tell you that there is an enormous wave of money that has gone towards this issue. And, well, hang on.
Shall we compare incomes? Well, I get £60,000 a year. Most researchers who work on climate change, I work with many of these, get between £28,000 and £40,000 a year. Most of them are on 1-year to 2-year contracts.
How much of the budget comes from the taxpayer?
Well, all money comes from the taxpayer, so all taxpayer, everything comes from the taxpayer.
No, it doesn't. There's taxpayer money and there's not.
No, the taxpayer money pays both of those. The private sector isn't paid more by taxpayers. We're all the same people.
Yeah?
Well, do you pay tax? Because you're a taxpayer. But you also buy things in the private market as well. This separation of tax and private is a mythical view that's kept a lot of people in business for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
We're all part of a system in which some of it is what we call private, some of it is what we call public. This idea of separating them out is a nonsensical view. It has been for many years.
Well, in the short answer to your question is that there are lots of people who disagree with this. There are lots and lots of people. But there has been a takeover of this issue by one side of the island, which has managed successfully with a lot of money, a lot of public
money,
to... No, just not true.
A lot less. Come on, the oil industry. Oil industry is a wash of money.
Heartland Institutes was going to spend $200,000 on influencing schools. That's what came out this week. What does WWF spend on school packages every year? $68 million. What is the total? It's true. It's true. I'll give you the data. It came from the Wall Street Journal yesterday. What is the total income of environmental NGOs in the United States? Every year.
That's private. That's not public money. That's private money.
I know. I'm about to tell you about some private money. I mean, one can change.
One's mine. Yeah,
that's not what I said. $10 billion a year. That's the total budget of the environmental NGOs. That dwarfs anything spent on the other side of the island.
Again, then you're actually comparing apples and pears, because you know that most of the NGOs and private NGOs in the US deal with local issues and state issues and are not within the actual climate change agenda. So therefore, you're actually putting...
Among the $10 billion.
All the environmentalists are talking about climate change. So you're again swapping apples and pears.
$10 billion. I mean, it's quite a lot of spare change for the climate.
Just to let Kevin understand this...
Most of my colleagues work 50 to 60 hours a week and they're getting £28,000 to £40,000 a year. The Tyndall Centre has had £10 million over 11 years now. So these are not large budgets, these are sort of budgets.
You've advised
a government.
You've advised a government.
I take no money, I take no consulting money at all. And I put back some of my expenses. So I pay for my own expenses out of my own salary. And you don't tell me what your salary is. What is your salary?
The
thing is, I don't actually enjoy boxing as a spectator sport. I did, however, spend some time last night watching a film by Stephen Schneider giving a lecture which explains very clearly why the discussion that we've been subjected to is a very poor discussion. But my point that I want to, I highly recommend it, is in the reading list that we were sent around, in case you didn't have a chance to see it. My point is, I can clearly understand what Matt's motive is. As a freelancer, you get invited to speak because you can be the token opposition. I don't understand what the motive of climate scientists is, collectively, to make all this up.
Can I just put you right on that? This is death to my career. This is the first time, actually, that I've had a public audience, that I've had an invitation to talk about this issue. Normally people don't want to touch you with a barge pole if you express any climate skepticism. Like, you should talk to my agent, she thinks I should never touch this stuff.
I haven't got an agent, by the way, so I don't have one.
Talk to my agent.
Yeah, but you don't need an agent to be a professor now.
I think we're here today, and the people are in this room, because we've decided that we ought to be living our lives in a different way, and that the things that we're hearing are not really touching our motivations and our feelings and our subconscious, that the argument that we've heard so far has been very much sort of on the left brain, very much about, you know, you're both throwing huge facts at each other. And the implication probably is that people would run away from all that, think it's way beyond us, it sounds awful, but actually that's just one thing. And people are talking to us about the global economy collapsing and the coral reefs collapsing and the injustice in the world. Let's go and have a drink. If we come back to how should we be living our lives now, and how should artists and creative people be creating a vision of how we could be living our lives, I'd like to know sort of what our speakers feel they can contribute to that, or what is the thing from what they've said that will change us when we go away to do things differently. And perhaps, you know, Matt, you might not want us to do things differently. You might think it's fine, but I think there are other things in the world that we need to change. Can I say just one more thing? And that's that, I haven't said this for about 20 years or so, but it is a bit odd at the moment that everybody that's been on the platform has been a white man. I do feel that part of the way that our world has gone wrong is that the things that culturally are more associated with women and with the rest of the world are very seldom represented in the discussions.
That's a very good point. When I was looking at the poster over there, I counted up before the session, and women are just under 2/3 of the people who are here.
We're listening.
I would argue that men are overrepresented in causing the problems. Anyway, let's come back to your question.
Disagree with that. The question was, how would we do things differently? I desperately want people to do things differently. I want change. I want technological change. I want innovation. I want adventure. I want enterprise. I want change for poor people particularly. You know, my passion here is to see that people are able to improve their lives, as so many people in the West have been able to. And we've trebled the income of the average person on this planet in the last 50 years. I think it would be wonderful if we could continue to do that. I'm terrified that some of Kevin's agenda would actually set that back, and that we would end up perpetuating more poverty. Now, he may think that that's an unfair thing to say. It's not. It's my genuine view.
My take. It's quite challenging as someone who works within science to bring our personal views into this. I have a lot of discussions with my colleagues. I've got a paper in my bag at the moment, so I've been talking about this, whether we as scientists should also respond as citizens. I take a very strong and strident view that we should, but not all my colleagues agree with that. So my views on what we should do are just premised on my take of the world as a citizen, not my take of the world as a scientist. I have made what are really relatively paltry efforts, but in a real world situation, but relative to the world that we live in, the wealthy parts of the world. You know, I haven't had a fridge for 12 years, My mission to come there basically living because I hardly ever heat my house and no one visits me in the winter, which is a benefit. I don't fly, I use a train everywhere I went, everywhere I go. So when I tried last year, I went by train there, back, it took a long time, a lot of sorting out. So it has changed a lot of my life, and some of it hasn't been for the better. But the reason I'm doing that is for exactly what Matt said. I think that the poor parts of the world need to have as much development as fast as possible. And unfortunately, in the short term, that will be allied with increasing emissions. So whilst Matt flies around the world, pontificating his views, I would say it's important not to fly around the world to give that emission space to the poor people to develop. So we have to get our emissions down. I'm not saying, I don't know much about this audience, if it's a science audience, I wouldn't know. We have to get our emissions down very rapidly to give the emission space for the poorer parts of the world to develop. And in the interim, we need to be developing these technologies that Matt and I are probably in broad agreement with. But ultimately, this is very much in the short term, is a philosophical cultural issue that can be benefited in the long term from technical change, and we may want to keep it philosophical and cultural, I don't know, for sustainability reasons we possibly can, we possibly need to. From a climate perspective, I think we can get ourselves out of this technically in the medium and long term, but it's cultural and philosophical in the short term.
Next question, please.
I'm an artist, not a scientist, so, you know, I just sit here and which of you two do I believe? So what I go to is, I actually heard Rupert Sheldrake talk last night, and there are certain systems and belief systems in place in the science community that I think restrain both of you with respect. I'm very grateful for many things that science has done for me, the planet, and continues to do. But on an intuitive level, I very strongly feel that we all know that certain elements of mankind are over-consuming, and that is having an interconnected knock-on effect with what we deem as a more intimate connection with nature. So to get back to why we're here today, I think it's very important that we maybe even park judgment on balance. You know, one of you might be right, the other one might be right, but I know there's a much greater risk if one of you is right and if I don't act. That's point one, you know, just straightforwardly. And point two, like I said, on an intuitive level, we all know that we feel more relaxed, happier through our creativity and our art, and our creativity and art in a greater sense with whatever we do, when we are consuming less and connected more with the natural flow of nature.
I think we've got time, and I'll let the guys make any response they want in a moment, but I think we've got time for just two more questions. It'll be fair to the part of the room. We'll take one from over here, so the green arm there that I can see, yes. And then we'll take one from this wing over here, Gareth there at the front. And then we'll have to leave it there and move on to the next session, I'm afraid. So please, green arm person, whoever you are.
Just for context, I trained first in science and then in theatre, so that's the kind of background I come to this. Also, I'm on 13K, so I don't know what that means. obviously, don't train in science and then theatre, probably. Anyway, I, unlike a few of the previous speakers, quite like a good climate science punch-up every so often. I prefer if it's not all white men, but often it is, just due to demographics, it's kind of a bit of a shame. I like a good climate science punch-up because it means I have to check what I already know about climate science, what I think I know, and what I believe about the future. And every time I come out a little bit uncertain and a little bit unsure about what side I come down on, and then I just remember about precaution. And I always end up in any of the, and I try again and again to look at climate science and look at climate science punch-ups and try and see if my mind can change. And every time I come back to needing to be precautionary about this, that if the one side of the debate that does seem to hold sway right now, and that's true, that does seem to hold sway right now, if the majority of climate scientists are right, then we have to make enormous changes to our lifestyle. And if the minority of climate scientists are wrong, and we don't necessarily have to make these changes, then we still should, in case we're wrong. I'm not an expert enough to be able to decide between these two people right now. I cannot spend enough of my time on science to be able to decide between the two. So all I'm left with doing is to be able to take the precaution that, assuming that climate scientists, the majority of them are right, then we have to do the kind of things that they're saying. That's the position that I end up in as a bit of a science amateur, as a bit of a theatre amateur, straddled somewhere between the two.
Okay, thanks for that. So we've got 2 points. One was really about what in posh language we would call the epistemology of science, really, some of the basic assumptions of the way scientists work. And then we have another issue here of someone interacting with what scientists are saying when there appears to be disagreement and the proportionary principle. Matt, would you like to
Because in a sense,
both of you touched on the precautionary principle, or Pascal's wager, which is a sort of version of the same thing, that, you know, that Pascal said, you better believe in God because the consequences are, could be terrible if you don't, if he does exist. My problem with that is that we know for sure that we're going to get real harm out of a lot of this emissions reduction. I mean, I talked about the 192,000 people who died in 2010 as a result of this. Kevin showed you these clips on his graph. That's the kind of thing. That's the thing I want to be precautionary about. Are we sure that we want to go over that cliff? Are we sure that we can keep living standards up? Are we sure we can prevent starvation if we don't use plenty of fossil fuels, if we don't give people in third world markets to sell their food in other countries, etc., etc.? So, in other words, I see the precautionary argument working the other way. I know, you know, essentially, it's a balance of risk. I used to think, like you, that the risk was so great that almost any price is worth paying. And I now think the other way around. I think the risk is all on the other side.
I distinctly remember in your slides, Kevin, that you did say at all costs at one point. So, that, anyway, let's have your take on this.
The all costs is, who's the we?
Yeah.
As someone pointed out, actually, it's white middle class, wealthy men in the Northern Hemisphere. But the we does include other people elsewhere, and does include a lot of women as well. But it's still a relatively small proportion of the population. So, I mean, I sort of slightly humbled by some of the comments that have been made, but I've heard they're pretty fair judgments. In the end, it does come back to Matt and I disagree. I think probably on the basis of who is the we. To me, the we that is in that all cost in that slide is the 1%. Okay, it might be 3%, it might be 10%, but it's not the 90%, it's not the majority. The we is the small group who have put the stuff out there, who are still putting the stuff out there, and will be putting the stuff out there tomorrow, there, to there, and we have to make changes to our lives. And if the very small minority have to make radical adjustments to their way of life, but can still have very good qualities of life, which I think we can easily do, and that will allow, even if it is through an individual proportionate approach, will allow the poor people in the world the wherewithal to have much better lives and allow their emissions to go up in the short term. That is a price and a cost that I, and I hope the other 1% that are likely, are prepared to pay. Because it doesn't mean us being uncivilized and living in caves, it just means us living as we did literally just a few decades ago, but with some of the really positive things as well that have come out of that period of time. So I do not think it is about an impoverished future for the minority. I think in some respects our future would actually be richer if we consumed a lot less, but it would give the space for the poor to consume more.
Thanks, Kevin. So one more question from Gareth Kane here, and then we'll have to move on to our next activity. You've been sat a long time, been very patient. So
maybe unlike some of the questioners, I actually enjoy a bit of Barney on this. But given the high the stakes are, if we go with the mainstream science, and the problem I have with Matt's point of view is, I'm not a climate scientist, but I saw at least two sleights of hand in the data. The two temperature model graphs, you were not comparing like with like. You were using one model and a completely different data set. You left out the data set that actually matches the model.
Yeah.
Why, if you're right, and we shouldn't go down this low carbon route, do you have to make those distortions?
I didn't make any distortion. The HAPCRAP data set shows just as big an increase as any of the other ones you choose to choose. I'm sorry, it does. It does. I can't even say.
It's cooler.
Cooler than which?
It's cooler than the GISS, which those models are.
But it's warmer than the NCDC one, and it's warmer than the RSS one. What do you mean, like? Well, I mean, you're saying I should have picked the one that showed the warmest. I picked the one satellite one that people quote most often, and the one surface one that people quote most often. And the difference was huge from the predictions. Even if I'd picked GISS, it would still be below the bottom line. Is it right?
Kevin, anything about that?
Yeah, the only thing is, I mean, quite a difficult time in terms of the climate community has come under some, and actually I think some good benefits come out of it, has come under a lot of pressure from skeptics. Now hopefully all climate scientists, all scientists are skeptics, by the nature they're skeptical. And actually I like the idea of a lot more of information. I'm a constructive socialist, I don't like patents, copyrights, I don't like any data being kept back at all.
I'm a big skeptic about patents, copyrights.
So I like the idea that it's opened up the information. information and the data. But it does feel to me that we've opened it up on the climate side, the sceptic side does not seem to have actually opened up anywhere near that same level. That's my take. And actually, I think what's happened recently, and this doesn't suggest that's the case, is that we are open about where our funding comes from. We are open about, you know, where our money comes from. We are open about now the data. And actually, most people were open about the data, but pretty much across the board now, scientists will put the data out there. And I think that's the way it should go. I still have the view that I think a lot of the climate skeptics I talk to do deliberately manipulate the stuff that they have, because they have a point to make, not a point to discover. And I think there's quite a big difference between those two.
Just go and read Steve McIntyre's stuff. His long, long struggle to get Michael Mann and his colleagues to put the data behind the hockey stick set.
Is it there now?
No, it's still not.
Well,
caught every step of the way and used every trick, including some pretty unpleasant tricks, to get a journalist to try and dig dirt on Steve McIntyre, that kind of thing. So I'm sorry, we're not taking any lessons on
Steve McIntyre.
Peter Clark this week, who's a climate scientist, fabricated a document and broke the law in order to try and blacken some organisation called the Heartland, which I don't know, you probably don't agree with, but, you know, and this is a man who's given lectures on scientific integrity to Congress. So, I'm sorry, you know, there's on both sides in this argument, people are sometimes using wrong data, sometimes selective, etc., etc. But the idea that the alarmist side has been pure and the skeptics not, I think, is not true.
And I would agree with them there, that's why I didn't say it.
Okay. Right, well, that's ended a point of agreement. It's obviously. You know, some people have enjoyed more than others the fact that we had two different takes on the same data and the implications thereof. I think actually there were a lot more points of agreement than we might have anticipated before the discussion. There were many points in which Matt and Kevin, you know, did actually agree the same data sets and all the rest of it. I would repeat what I said before. I think they both deserve a lot of thanks from both of us for going to the trouble to put the presentations together. They obviously both feel passionately about what they do, and certainly as far as I'm concerned, I think they've both done us proud and given us a really lively start and backdrop to all of the discussions that we have for the rest of these couple of days together. So, in that spirit,
the point that was quite a few people made, they felt it was a bit too much, you know, language more relevant to particular audiences, that it was perhaps too fisticuffs, and perhaps we need to go away and think about not, you know, not with each other, but with other people, how we may approach how we might approach these sorts of things in the future, because it isn't an approach that is appealing to everyone.
Okay, well, let me conclude what I was saying. I think that Matt and Kevin both did fine jobs, but we knew that there would be a lively discussion. I think that they both kept within the bounds of civility, which is something I'm very grateful for, being sat between the two of them. It's not an easy thing to put yourself up on a public platform like this when you know that there's going to be someone else who has a different take on what you inevitably hold dear, because it's what you spend all of your working time thinking about and doing. It's not an easy thing to do, and it's not easy, you know, to particularly for Matt's take to come into an event which has been organised around the supposition that there's a job to do and there's a serious issue to address with climate, and express what are unorthodox views. So I think, you know, we need to bear that in mind when you join me in applauding Matt and Kevin for taking the time to come and help us.